With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
You have to expose yourself in all your awe and all your search for beauty and for something truthful out there. You have to immerse yourself into a certain amount of danger. And we have been very prudent, as I said in the film, I think in the industry, I'm the only one who is clinically sane. And I'm saying that in contrast to the kind of mythology that has sprung up in the internet or wherever, in public opinion, in the media. And it's not based by anything stupid that I've done and anything crazy I've done.
I'm Alex Pasternak on Radio Motherboard, and Werner Herzog is something like a force of nature. Even if you haven't seen his films, you know them. You know his Teutonic, tectonic voice, and perhaps his reputation. And if you haven't seen them, well, there's plenty of good places to start. He's made about 60 films over 50 years. In the past year alone, he made a documentary about volcanoes, Into the Inferno, and lo and behold, about the internet, as well as two feature films, Queen of the Desert, starring Nicole Kidman, and Salt and Fire, with Gael Garcia Bernal, which is actually also about volcanoes to some extent. His dozens of movies range across the strange and sublime and terrible terrain of human experience. Lyrical documentaries like Grizzly Man and Encounters at the End of the World, and La Soufrière, which is also about a volcano. There are absurdist fables like Strozek, about a mentally challenged ex-con, an old man and a prostitute who leave Germany for the promised land of rural Wisconsin. There are epics like Fitzcarraldo, for which Herzog famously, infamously, orchestrated the pulling of a ship over a mountain in Peru. This incident became a metaphor in many ways for Herzog's ethos, but a number of others have contributed to the Herzog legend over the years. The idea that he seems to thrive in and even attract dangers. One of my favorite Herzogian moments isn't in any of his films. It's when he was being interviewed by the BBC and then all of a sudden, bang, Herzog had been shot on camera. He seemed to keep going. He brushed it off. It turned out to be an air rifle, some sort of prankster nearby.
It's pretty incredible. You can find this clip online, along with any number of Herzog memes and caricatures by what he calls internet imposters. But Herzog doesn't care what other people think about him, about his mythos.
He does, however, care about myth, the stories people tell, and why. His new movie, Into the Inferno, is as much about the nature and science of volcanoes as it is about the culture and ideas that surround them. His guide is Clive Oppenheimer, a scientist he met while filming in Antarctica, who guides him across six volcanoes and even into an active danger zone where they keep their eyes on the cone at all times. And there is, of course, an embarrassment of eye-popping up-close volcano footage, some of it shot by drone, some of it shot by Herzog and his cinematographer, and some of it shot by a French couple, Katia and Maurice Kraft, a pair of volcanologists
who obsessively chronicled volcanoes up close. Too close, it turns out.
This is not, Herzog says, a National Geographic. It's more like what he calls a fever dream of the jungle.
We spoke recently by phone and discussed science and scientists, the role that humans play in nature and the environment, and even police body cameras and the terrible films they produce.
Hi, Werner. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Where are you, if I may ask?
That's exactly what I was about to ask you.
I'm in Los Angeles, where I live.
Okay, in your home?
Yeah.
Where do you do these kinds of interviews?
May I ask first, where are you?
Yeah, sure.
Of the continent.
I know, you did ask first. I am in New York, I'm in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg. I'm in my house, in my bedroom at the moment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Where do you do your business from during the day?
I do it literally wherever I am. I can write a screenplay or continue writing a screenplay in a busy airport hall, departure area of an airport, or on a crowded bus, or at home and doing my tax returns in between. And answering the phone, so I don't need a very specific place.
I love working on buses, too, and airports. Do you tend to write on a computer, or do you use a pen?
On a laptop, yeah. I used to write on a typewriter, but those days are over, because I'm not using paper.
You mean for environmental reasons?
In a way, yes. I don't like the idea that there's too much paper being, too many trees wasted, and that's a charm of the internet, that you have publications on the internet, and the millions of tons of pulp from trees is not needed to such an extent anymore.
Although, when I think about the internet, as someone who writes for the internet and edits articles for the internet, and who lives on the internet, really, it feels like a constant barrage, like it's this sort of endless book. Whereas a book itself is so limited and focused. And I also feel like with writing by hand is obviously a different process, different mental process than writing with a computer. But of course, most of my writing I do on the computer too, and I do wonder how that affects my writing.
I do write in longhand when I watch the footage that I shot. Mm. I watch it together with my editor, and I write what I call log books. I write in longhand, and because of that, I do memorize many, many, many hours of film as if it was completely present.
Hmm.
It vanishes after I'm done editing, but I can really almost perfectly memorize images and scenes and characters and situations because I wrote it down. I watched it and wrote down what I saw in longhand.
And that doesn't happen if you were typing on a computer.
It doesn't happen like that. Yes, I remember more if I write down something. But in longhand, it's very strange.
Thinking of handwriting and other things that get lost over time, I mentioned I'd heard about Last Whispers, a multimedia exhibit that his wife, the photographer Lena Herzog, recently mounted at the British Museum. The exhibit focuses on endangered languages, languages that are spoken by only a few people on Earth. I asked Herzog if he shared this concern for disappearing things.
There's something alarming going on. The extinction of languages occurs with much higher speed than the extinction of species, of animals or plants. It's staggering. Of all the languages that we have right now, 7,000 or so, maybe 5% will be left by the end of this century. And it's not just languages, it means a worldview with a language. And it's just imagine the last Russian disappearing, and there would be no more Tolstoy, there would be no more music by Tchaikovsky, there would be no more poetry by Akhmatova or Tsvetaeva. It's just unspeakable.
Literally.
Unspeakable. The drama is unspeakable. What is happening to people who live under the volcano, mm-hmm. and how do they create monsters and demons and gods new gods. And of course, that's fascinating for filmmaking because I'm into storytelling. And of course, the awesome beauty and ferocity of volcanic events is just staggering. And at the same time, the mythologies that are springing up are staggering and beautiful. Like John Frum, a mythical GI who would return through the volcano on a Pacific island,
right,
and bring all the goods, chewing gum and jukeboxes, mm-hmm, and fridges and maybe even a Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
Or in North Korea,
it's wild.
The new god, the leader, the founding father of the socialist North Korea, Kim Il-sung, who has an almost godlike status. He now, after his death, became president for eternity.
Mm.
And because of that, we have not seen a new president in North Korea anymore. His son and his grandson have never adopted the title of president.
Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it's obvious, but it does seem like film and documentary it has this kind of anthropological role in capturing things that might be escaping us and that we may never get to see if not for these things. And I wonder if that's something that drives you.
Well, basically looking very deep inside of us. What are we? How do we function as human beings? What is awesome for us? What is storytelling for us? What is poetry for us? Where are our fears and glories? So it's a very anthropological look at volcanoes, for example. It's not what National Geographic would have done.
No.
Thanks God I did that one.
What's that?
Thanks God I did the film and not National Geographic.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's distinctively Herzogian.
The sun dimmeth, the land sinketh, gusheth forth steam and gutting fire. To the heavens soar the hurtling flames of the mighty gods, the engulfing doom. It is hard to take your eyes off the fire that burns deep under our feet.
This was a monstrous volcanic eruption, one of the largest in all of Earth history.
Obviously, there was a scientific side to our journey, but what we were really chasing was the magical side, no matter how strange things might eventually get.
How did this project come about to begin with? What was the origin of it?
As you see in the film, it has a prehistory. I did a film 40 years ago on a volcano in Guadeloupe about one man who refused to be evacuated. 10 years ago, I met Clive Oppenheimer on a volcano in Antarctica. So it's a recurring sort of thing. I just made a feature film, which hasn't been published yet, Salt and Fire.
Yes.
And marginally, there is also a volcano visible and some talk about it. Not much, but it's somehow recurring because they're so awesome and they have such a incredible beauty and vigor and something very, very cinematic.
You work so much with Clive Oppenheimer, a scientist. And thinking about, you know, this anthropological impulse, I guess I wonder generally what your relationship is with science and scientists. Being someone who I think is obviously not a scientist, very much an artist.
Well, sometimes we cover common ground and we start marveling at things that defy our experience in the real world. Just very recently, I was with scientists who are into the field of quantum physics, and what they tell me is kind of fascinating, that things that correspond to our experience with the world do not count anymore in this most minuscule world. A particle that is shot against a wall has to pass through a window left or a window right, and why does a particle choose the left window and next time the right window? But the crazy thing is that there seems to be evidence that some single particles pass through both windows at the same time.
Right.
So it's and there's something of great awe in this, and something beautiful and almost poetic.
It's the unexplained, I guess. These are the things that both scientists and artists deal with, right?
Yeah, and things that somehow defy our experience. And I've always been after things in my film that, in a way, defy our normal relationship with the world. A ski flyer who defies gravity, or moving a ship over a mountain. There's a dialogue in Fitzcarraldo where Fitzcarraldo is asking, how do we get the ship over the mountain? And he answers, like, the cow flies over the moon. That's the answer.
Sure.
And I actually moved this ship over the mountain in one single piece. It's not a technical trick.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, in many ways, it feels like an experiment that you embarked on. And
it's defiance of gravity for the sake of gaining something awesome, for gaining sheer poetry, sheer fever dreams in the jungle.
There's only so much planning that you can do for something like that, and for any kind of film, but, I mean, especially for something like Fitzcarraldo. It makes me think, to extend this metaphor, the scientific one, and maybe it's useless to do this, but it makes me think of films as a sort of experiment where you start off with a kind of question, like a scientist does. You don't know where it's going to go. It might fail, or there might be accidents along the way.
But they stay curious.
Right. You made a film about a volcano years ago. Even the title sort of suggests a theme that's in a lot of your films, going into something that is dangerous.
Yeah. You should be cautious with the title. It was not invented by me. I had a title that nobody wanted. And then my partners in England came up with this, and everybody was completely excited and enthusiastic. We got it. And everybody. So I said, okay, let's call it Into the Inferno.
Wow.
I can live with it easily, so there's no deeper meaning.
Wow.
But I know exactly what you mean. You have to expose yourself in all your awe and all your search for beauty and for something truthful out there. You have to immerse yourself into a certain amount of danger. And we have been very prudent. As I said in the film, I think in the industry, I'm the only one who is clinically sane. And I'm saying that in contrast to the kind of mythology that has sprung up in the internet or wherever, in public opinion, in the media. And it's not based by anything stupid that I've done or anything crazy I've done.
And working with a team of people, I mean...
Yeah, of course, whatever is out there in terms of public opinion, you cannot change, and I just leave it as it is.
Do you have reservations about your reputation in the culture?
No, I don't care. I don't care, and of course, when you look at the internet, and you probably have seen it, I'm on Facebook, but it's imposters. I'm on Twitter, it's imposters. There are voice impersonators. There are all sorts of things out, and it's not me. And I think we have to get accustomed that representation of self in the internet has completely changed in the last few years. And I can live with it. I don't really care much about it. Sometimes I feel all these doppelgangers are my unpaid bodyguards.
Mm.
Let them do battle out there, fine.
Sounds like the topic of an interesting film, maybe. What was the original title that you wanted for the Into the Inferno?
Oh, I won't tell you. I think it was Boring.
Oh, come on.
Which normally doesn't happen to me, because I always have beautiful titles like Land of Silence and Darkness, you just name it.
Oh, I'd love to know what the original was.
I do have good titles.
No, you do. They're great. And, I mean, Into the Inferno sounds sort of, it's like Into the Abyss, maybe. I hope people don't think it's a sequel or anything.
Don't try to enforce
a
connection too hard because of the title.
You know, scientists often talk about having big problems and big questions that they confront over the course sometimes of their careers. And I know, you're not a scientist, but I wonder if, for you, you think of your work as grappling with a particular problem or a particular question. And how do you answer that? How do you deal with that? And I mean that on a broad scale. I mean, I guess, what's your problem? What's your big problem?
I think I don't have a big problem per se, and I'm not making the big problem about that one. I think my films are too diverse and too different in subject, but of course, when you look at them in their totality, you would immediately notice they belong together.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't know what sort of big problem I have.
Well, I guess your big challenge in terms of making any film, I mean, what's the main thing to sort of have to overcome? If you can reduce it to one thing or a couple things.
Well, I've always managed to, in the practical performance of doing films, one obstacle after the other. That's the nature of filmmaking. As a filmmaker, you have to be capable to cope with it. And you have to cope with money, and you have to cope with public opinion, and you have to cope with censorship, and you have to cope with bureaucracy. You have to be streetwise.
You deal with a lot of landscapes and nature, obviously, and also with this sense of nature, as you describe it, being sort of indifferent. And now we live in a time where we have to deal with climate change and pollution and so on, and this notion that we are intertwined with nature. And we also live on the internet and kind of away from nature. And so do you feel sort of an environmental urge or have an environmental message that you think is important?
I think there are others who pass it on better than me. Of course, it's a huge question. And in a way, we are dealing with it in the segment of Ethiopia where paleontologist who has found prehistoric workshop of obsidian tools, and we ask him, do we have another 100,000 years? And he gives an interesting answer. With all the mistakes we are committing right now, the human race will be, in his opinion, in a critical phase in about 1,000 years from now. And he probably is right, and we have to learn very quickly from mistakes, otherwise will be just unnecessary here on this planet anymore. I mean, I think we were never necessary. but it's one of these things that happened in evolution, and so we are here and we better make the best of it. I'm against colonizing Mars as a safe haven.
Really?
We should better look into making our planet more habitable than it is right now.
In Lo and Behold, which I loved also, I saw you mentioned to Elon Musk that you would go to Mars if you had the chance. Would you?
I would if I had a camera.
Okay.
If I had a camera, sure.
But you think it's a bad...
Otherwise, the idea of colonizing Mars in order to have a safe planet for refugees from our own planet is a very misconceived idea. I believe it's not going to happen. It's one of those technical utopias that's, in my opinion, not going to happen. Other utopias will occur, and they have to do more with the internet, for example.
Oh, what do you mean?
That we'll see a lot of new things coming up because of the internet that will be very significant.
What sort of things are you thinking about? After your work on Lo and Behold, are there things that you really think are important to focus on?
Well, I don't want to be a prophet now. Let's drop this whole thing. But I know this is only a tiny beginning.
What was the experience like of making a feature now versus the process of making a documentary?
You shouldn't think that these features are the exotic, some sort of stragglers. I think I made 7 or 8 feature films in the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
People normally, it's the problem is that some of them have not been seen in theaters, like, for example, Queen of the Desert.
Yes.
A big epic film with Nicole Kidman, which should have been shown more than a year ago, but there was a glitch between distributor and the producer over distribution of certain costs.
Mm-hmm.
These things happen.
Sure.
But the film should have been out and much more prominent than any of my documentaries. And I made, as I said, at least 7 or 8 feature films in the last decade, and that's quite a bit.
Given the changing landscape of the media world and the internet and Hollywood, has it become in some ways easier for you, or has it become challenging in new ways to get these films made?
No, not easier, but I acknowledge the phenomenal possibilities of the internet, for example. I did a film about texting and driving on YouTube.
Right.
Which had a phenomenal success, and it actually changed behavior of people who were driving and at the same time texting, and that led to catastrophic accidents. And whoever of the millions of people who saw this film will ever, ever, ever text again while driving. I'm convinced of that. For example, the film about the internet,
right,
of course, originally was meant to be a film for YouTube,
mm-hmm.
short 5-minute films, and NetScout, a very, very big internet company that keeps gigantic flows of data flowing and mm-hmm. checks for anomalies, and so they understood, yes, it has to be a much bigger film, much deeper plowing. And so I had some very good experiences with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, Into the Inferno will be available on the, I think, 28th of October. And symbolically now I'm saying Netflix will push a button. The film will be available in 190 countries.
Wow.
At the same moment. 17 language versions. Many more languages in terms of subtitles. So it's something worldwide. It's going to be shown in Bangladesh and in Uruguay and in India and Finland.
That's amazing.
And the United States and, I don't know, Lebanon.
I hope that the people who watch it at home can project it on a big screen, because I think it deserves that.
That's the downside. The simultaneous theatrical release is very small in comparison to the worldwide internet release.
Sure.
When you mentioned the size of screens, many people, of course, have fairly large plasma screens nowadays. What I regret, which is going to be missing at least today, is the quality of sound. When you hear in a theater, and I showed it in Telluride, with a phenomenal sound system, and you feel the rumbling under your seats, and you're somehow the vibrations of the subwoofers or so somehow are passing under you, and then you see it exploding.
Mm.
So the phenomenon in the quality of sound will be missing, but I think fairly soon we'll have systems at home where the sound will be much improved.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I was thinking recently of Strozek and its depiction of America. It's sort of poor rural America. This is a film you made decades ago. And there's something about it between this sense of hilarity and despair. I think about that, and I think about the other kind of depiction of America we're seeing now through the lens of another character who's running for president. And I guess I wonder to you if our country looks as strange as it did in the era of Strozek and as it does to me.
There's something in Strozek which doesn't make the film age. It's only the cars are aging that you see in the film. It's, in a way, it seems to be timeless. And it is a deep, deep look into the heart of what America is showing. I don't know whether you can make a connection to the elections right now. We should be careful. But for me, I'm in a situation where I cannot vote because I'm not a citizen.
Mm.
But it's very, very good and interesting times for you voters out there.
It is. I mean, it's interesting times generally. It's a little bit scary sometimes.
It's fine that you find things scary, but you don't need to panic.
Mm. My last question is related to filmmaking and videos. I've been thinking a lot about police videos that we see on the internet, that we see on television, things that we have to confront but are pretty terrible to look at. And I wonder, if you look at these things, if you see them and you have an idea of how they fit into the history of cinema or how they fit into our culture and what they do to us, as someone who deals with visual images so much?
Yeah, well, it's... I think it's good that these body cameras, for example, exist. It is a new form of reality, and we have to learn how to deal with it. My hope is that, for example, a policeman will think twice about whether he or she should open fire, depending, of course, on the situation. And I would assume that police are quite good people here in the United States. I have no doubt whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some of them are in panic or stupid and reckless and whatever. There are exceptions. And those who are the exceptions will think twice, knowing that they are on camera. Mm. So it may be to some advantage. We have to see. We have to see how it plays out within the next, let's say, decade or so. I couldn't care less about the cameras in the bank when you're at the bank cashing a check and you have 15 cameras on you. I couldn't care less about these cameras.
Yeah, the surveillance.
They don't have much effect. And bank robberies have shifted more to the internet.
Mm-hmm, right. Oh, man, another problem. Are you going to relax now? Do you get to go on a vacation after your year of... You have a new school, an online course. You've made how many films this year? Three, maybe.
Yeah, and the fourth one, which is unpublished, Queen of the Desert. No, it's okay. I love what I do, and I'm kind of relaxed. I plow on quietly, and... I'm never hectic, I'm not a workaholic, but there are a couple of feature film projects looming, and I have to deal with it fairly soon.
All right, well, good luck with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks all for right. talking. I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Yeah, all right. Take good care.
You too. Goodbye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening, and thank you to Werner Herzog. Radio Motherboard is a production of Vice Media and Motherboard, and this episode was edited by Tim Barnes. Thanks a lot, Tim. For more interesting stories, subscribe to the Motherboard podcast, however you like to do that. And on our website, you can learn more about volcanoes. There's an interview with the volcanologist behind Into the Inferno. And you can also find an interview I did with Herzog a few years ago after his film Into the Abyss. That and a lot more is at motherboard.vice.com. Thanks.